on a Wednesday. Welcome to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
Hello, folks. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Coming up on the show today, we're going to talk about online dating scams. Have you or somebody you know been a victim, or have you maybe caught a scammer in the act? We want to hear from you. Call us. We'll also have an expert standing by, but the number to call is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
Looking forward to that discussion. Also this hour, though, food allergies in kids. A new peanut patch is showing promise for increasing little ones' tolerance to a nut that sometimes causes a severe reaction, even a trip to the hospital. But before we get to all that, Avi, we got to do our jobs. First, we got to jump into this news.
We're starting with food, actually, right?
We are. Do you like Taco Tuesday?
I like tacos on any day.
Yeah, it's my favorite day of the week. And now it's the subject of headlines because a Jersey Shore restaurant and bar is in a legal battle over the use of the term Taco Tuesday. Owners of Gregory's Restaurant in Summers Point, Atlantic County, has told visitors that the restaurant is the origin of Taco Tuesday, dating back to 1979. That's according to the restaurant. They filed for the trademark in 1982, but never submitted evidence of first use. Then in 89, a Wyoming-based company, Taco John's, applied for a trademark as well. Litigation followed, and Gregory's won the right to use Taco Tuesday just in New Jersey. Now Taco Bell, you heard of that place, right, Avi?
Yes.
Well, now they're fighting to free the term Taco Tuesday. They want anybody to be able to use it. They argue that what if brunch was trademarked, right? It'd be chaos. So they want they want a free Taco Tuesday. And this is a later chapter in the beef over the use of the term. We use it all the time. I think we even talked about tacos, right?
Mm-hmm.
LeBron James even tried to trademark it back in 2019. Of course, he was unsuccessful. But, you know, this is just going back and forth over trademark law. So we'll see. The USPTO, that is the Patent and Trademark Office, they've given a hint to say that, you know, Taco Tuesday has become very commonplace. So Gregory's might lose out. We'll see.
Well, they're winning out because we're talking about them on the radio.
We are.
So
and they're getting a lot of attention. I'm
Gregory's
sure.
Wins no matter what. I have a few opinions about
yes.
this. One, first of all, why are we doing this story on a Wednesday? We should have done it yesterday on Tuesday. Big swing and a miss
by
us.
I know.
Two, I am torn because my heart wants to root for the little guy, which is Gregory's, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But I do kind of feel like we should all be able to use the term Taco Tuesday. It is a celebration of a wonderful food, and it's a real pick-me-up on a day of the week that really has not a lot else going for it. So I am torn between rooting for the little guy Gregory's and rooting for the general concept of Taco Tuesdays.
Yeah, I kind of feel your pain, man, because you know how much we love Taco Tuesday. And if we were in Jersey, we might not be able to say it because,
that's
you
right.
know, but we're in, luckily we're based in Philadelphia, you know, Philadelphia here in Pennsylvania. So, and Gregory's doesn't have the rights in
Fair
Pennsylvania
enough.
Right now. So.
Speaking of confusing labels, if you are ever wandering in the area just north of Rittenhouse Square in Center City, Philadelphia, you will notice on the street signs, a few of them, it says that you are in something called the French Quarter. And it's very confusing because no one that I've ever known here in Philadelphia has ever referred to any neighborhood as the French Quarter. So Billy Penn does what they do best, our
yes,
good friends at Billy Penn.
Asha
Prihar, one of their reporters, dug into how this area, which is between 17th and 19th Streets, Sansom and Walnut, got dubbed the French Quarter. And it's kind of a silly story. Basically, at some point in time around the late 90s, early 2000s, there was like a handful of French-themed businesses in this region, like restaurants, one was a hotel, nothing major. It wasn't like this was some sort of cultural hub. But that snowballed into a little publicity campaign, and they labeled this area the French Quarter. You know, kind of silly. But they just never backtracked on it. They never took down the signs. And I guess it is Philadelphia's French Quarter from now until forever.
Yeah. And I thought about it and I said to myself, well, Philadelphia is a Greek term. What Frenchy thing we have. But then we do have that on the Ben Franklin Parkway, you know, that we have a beautiful fountain like the Champs-Élysées.
Right.
We, you know,
that should be the French
Quarter. We also have Rittenhouse Square, which was reimagined by a French architect in the early 1900s. So we do have some French-iness. Right. But I don't know if we have a French Quarter, especially because
I'll clarify. We don't have a French Quarter.
We don't.
We have a French Quarter in name. We do not have a French Quarter in
spirit. Yeah, because the one in New Orleans is just so...
That's unique. A real French Quarter.
Yeah, it's really amazing. So
anyway, so good on the marketers for getting that to stick, even though it makes absolutely no sense.
Yeah, and we've been talking about book bans on and off on this show. And there is an effort in New Jersey to ban book bans. So ban the ban.
Ban the ban, interesting.
And not the books. Democratic lawmakers there introduced legislation to prohibit public schools and libraries from banning books. Schools must adopt the American Library Bill of Rights or something similar, and they have to agree to not remove books for partisan or doctrinal views. The libraries have to challenge censorship and respect all points of view, or they risk losing state funding if books are removed. Your thoughts on that, Avi?
It's like the anti-Florida, basically.
Basically, yeah.
I don't know. It seems interesting. I guess it's novel. I haven't heard of this happening in any other state. So I'll just be interested to see if they put it into action, whether it actually works. Because some things, like, they sound like they'd work in theory, and then they get really messy when you try to apply them. Be interesting if they did this, then they actually pulled funding from some school district that banned a book.
Yeah, but I feel like it kind of goes against the whole idea of being anti-ban to put in a ban. But, you know, but I want to just mention this because, you know, on Twitter, there was this whole dust up over, you know, the nation's first youth poet laureate, Amanda Gorman's inaugural book, The Hill We Climb, that was banned from lower grades at a school in Florida. And that caused this whole dust up, you know, over book bans again. And so New Jersey clearly putting their stake in the ground, their anti-book ban.
This is a trend in New Jersey, too, because, you know, in this same like kind of locus of culture war politics, Florida has also been a leader in trying to ban transitional care for people who identify as transgender. And New Jersey, remember we did a story recently, basically declaring itself the anti-Florida on that front as well. So it does seem like there's a little tit-for-tat going on politically. And these issues are not exactly the same, but they are related.
Yeah, very interesting. New Jersey's an interesting place, just like Florida's an interesting place.
Oh, it's plenty of interest. Mm-hmm. Bob Dylan, he's pretty literary. He's written a couple of books. I believe he's the only singer-songwriter to win the Nobel Prize for Literature still. And Bob Dylan turns 82 years old today. Happy birthday,
Happy birthday, Bob Dylan.
And what does that mean locally? So for more than 20 years, two Philly singer-songwriters have organized a free concert where lots of musicians get together and play Bob Dylan covers live. I believe it's 40 musicians this year. It'll be tonight, 7 o'clock at the Ardmore Music Hall, big old long tribute to Bob Dylan, who again is having his birthday today. Let's play a little Bob Dylan, why don't we?
And his visions of Johanna that conquer my mind.
Visions of Johanna, that's actually a nice deep cut. Well done, producers. I thought it was going to be Blown in the Wind or something off the top of the Bob Dylan repertoire. Oh, anyway, 7 p.m. tonight, Ardmore Music Hall, if you want to enjoy some Bob Dylan, celebrate his birthday. He's 82 years old.
Yeah, lots of diverse, talented artists to perform. So looking forward to that.
All right. So we're going to bring in our newsmaker today. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of a WHYY-themed newsmaker. Mm-hmm. If you hadn't heard, we here at WHYY have a new podcast in our podcast family. It's called Hittin' Season, and it's all about the Philadelphia Phillies. This is our first sports-themed podcast. Now, the podcast existed before, but it's just recently been bought into the WHYY family, and we have one of the hosts, the brainchild behind Hittin' Season, John Stolness, on the line to tell us a little bit more about the podcast. John, welcome to Studio 2.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. Good afternoon.
Yes, we're happy to have you here. So tell us about this podcast and what makes it so special.
Sure. We started it back in the dark days of 2015 when that really good team from 07 to 11 was getting torn down. And so I jumped right into the middle of the rebuild, and we were kind of wading through some pretty rough years there. And now that we've got a good baseball team, we've been doing it for the last few years. We do 3 podcasts a week where we talk about the team. We talk about what's going on and how the city is interacting with the team. I think we try to reflect how fans are feeling about the team both day to day and kind of looking forward. And I think in a lot of ways we try to help people either, you know, come together to share their emotions, both positively and negatively. And so far this year, based on what we've seen, mostly negative.
Yeah. Give me a sense, John, of how it differs from more traditional sports coverage, because we might have listeners who, you know, read the columnists in the big papers, you know, perhaps watch the team on NBC Sports, Philadelphia, watch, you know, game by game. What are they getting from the Hit and Season podcast that's got like a slightly different flavor than that stuff?
Sure. So we're a little different from talk radio in that we're not always trying to fire out the hot takes that are going to get people mad just to draw a reaction. We really try to take a look at what's happening, what people are doing, what fans are saying, and kind of address some of those issues. So we're not really in the clubhouse talking to players and getting those in-depth interviews. The beat writers do a really good job of that, but we are reacting to a lot of those different kinds of things. And so, you know, we'll react to Rob Thompson calling the team a 95-win team when they're not playing that way. And we'll kind of go behind some of the numbers too. The baseball's filled with numbers, so every once in a while we'll take a peek at what some of the numbers are saying and see if we can't look ahead and see if those numbers tell us anything that maybe our eyes aren't telling us. And what we like to do on the podcast as well is talk to some folks outside the city to sometimes give us a 10,000 foot view of this team, because we can get so wrapped up in our own feelings and emotions about the team that we lose the forest for the trees sometimes. So it's kind of bringing people back to the center a little bit. And so I think it kind of threads the needle between what you would get from the beat writers who report on the team in the newspapers and what you would get on sports talk radio, and try and find a good fan voice, somebody who, you know, Justin Clue, Liz Rocher, and I have been watching this team since we were kids. So we've got 15, 20 years of watching this baseball team, and we can look back on historical context and put it all into focus.
Yeah. So I want to zoom out and get your take on the Phils right now. What are some challenges and opportunities you see in this season?
Well, the thing that makes this Phillies team unique is that it's got a lot of really good players on it, right? I mean, you've got a lineup filled with guys making big money on big contracts. I think this is a team that is a good team. It's a good team filled with good players who aren't playing good. And I wish it was more complicated than that, but frankly, these guys have all had a lot of success in the past, both the lineup and the starting rotation, and they're just not playing good. And there are little reasons why. You know, I'm sure that they expected to get off to a faster start than they have been. And you've got some guys who I think are pressing. We've had some injury issues early in the season that the team had to try and work through. But it's not like you can send Trey Turner down to the minor leagues to rehab his swing. He's a superstar who's not playing like one. Same with a lot of the guys in the lineup and in the starting rotation. And so it's really kind of a frustrating wait and see right now for fans, because what we're experiencing this year is very similar to how the team started off last season. And I think we were expecting something a little different.
I have about 30 seconds left, John. Can you explain briefly for folks who might not get the reference, why is the podcast called Hittin' Season?
Right. So Charlie Manuel, the former manager, always used to say when the weather would heat up, it's hitting season now. You know, when the weather gets hotter, the ball flies around the ballpark a little bit better. And obviously, Charlie Manuel is a beloved figure in Philadelphia. We loved those teams that won the World Series and went to the playoffs 5 straight years. So kind of an homage to Charlie Manuel and some really great teams that I think was the genesis for a lot of Phillies fans here in the city.
A great manager, a great phrase, and now a great podcast, Hittin' Season. That is John Stolness, one of the co-hosts of the program. It's just new to the WHYY podcast family, and we're so excited to have it. 3 episodes a week. You can download it wherever you get your pods. John, thanks so much for joining us.
You bet. Thanks for having me, guys.
Wonderful. And coming up, it's getting harder to detect romance scammers online. Victims are losing a lot. Tune in and stick with us for this conversation.
But don't think twice, it's all right.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
So glad to have you back. This is Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Now we are talking about romance scams, sometimes called catfishing, those online schemes where the scammer lures a person into a relationship, often to get money from them. Well, these scams are booming. Last year, Americans reported losing over $1 billion, yes, billion with a B, to these scammers.
And if you think about it, Cherry, this spike in romance scams is the result of larger societal trends all converging. We've got the rise in online dating. Lots of people are on those platforms. We've got feelings of isolation amplified by the pandemic. Scammers prey on that. And even more recently, the proliferation of artificial intelligence, which can make these cons more and more sophisticated and harder to detect. So a lot to parse through. That's why we've brought in Anshul Rege, a Temple professor who studies romance scams. Anshul Rege, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
And you can join our conversation. Have you been a victim of a dating scam or know someone else who has? You can also call us for a friend. Do that. Have you been targeted? Call or email 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
So let's start here. Can you walk me through a typical romance scam, sort of how it might unfold?
Sure.
A hypothetical one.
Mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter if you're using, you know, the latest apps or if you use more traditional websites, right? It's typically a scam will unfold in about four steps, right? And the first part is obviously you want to set the bait. You have to be appealing in your profile, in your visuals. So you're going to create that because as a scammer, I'm not going to use my real name. I'm not going to use my real image. So I'm going to use somebody else's, right? Right from there, the deception started, right? You're not even presenting yourself as your true self. Then you're going to sort of hook the person in. You know, these would be those, hey, how are you doing? You look gorgeous, right? And then you start having these conversations. Oh, we have so much in common. You know, we share so many different things together. We have the same likes. This is known as a grooming stage, or more preferably love bombing. Mm. This is intense showering of affection, of attention. And I'm talking about regular conversations, nonstop conversations, sending you love songs, sending you flowers, sending you all these types of
not
things.
Not once a week, but much more.
You know, your conversations would be multiple times back and forth through text. Morning, I woke up thinking about you. During the day, hey, you know, I wish we were having this lunch together, right? Like all of these things. I'm cooking. I wish you were here by my side. So it's very much embedding them into your daily lifestyle. So it feels like you have a bond with the person. And so, you know, they're going to tell you about their family, right? Their family, which doesn't exist, but they're going to tell you about their family and they're going to learn about yours, which as a victim, you're going to be honest and sincere because this is potentially your soulmate. This sort of grooming process, anywhere from 6 months, 8 months, a year, right? Mm. And then they're going to figure out, are you ready? Are you primed? Mm. And this doesn't necessarily have to be a financial ask first. It could be a racy photo. Do I feel comfortable enough to share that with you? I do. I'm primed. I'm ready, right? And then all of a sudden, something's going to happen in the scammer's life. So this is based on that 6 to 8 month. You've set up a story, you know, I am a military officer stationed abroad, or I'm a physician working in, you know, a developing country. I want to help, you know, people here. Whatever, however you've set that story up, the circumstances will emerge based on that. So, oh no, you know, I need equipment for my hospital. Can you help out? Or, hey, my kid's trying to get through school. I need a little bit of help. I lost my job. Can you help me out with tuition this month?
Right. And all of a sudden, money's in the equation.
Right. Yeah. And it's not necessarily, again, a big ask. The way they're going to frame it, they're very clever. They're going to say, well, I have some savings. I just need a little bit, a little bit. Right. And that little bit then goes into pivots into something else and something else. And before you know it, you know, you're down a significant amount of money.
Interesting.
And I want to bring in this clip because I want to hear from someone who's like the person. This is Kate Kleinert, a victim of a romance scam who lost thousands.
By the time I realized that all of this was not true and that I had been duped, I felt stupid. I was embarrassed. I didn't want to tell people that I had fallen for someone who took such advantage of me. I felt so betrayed because I believed him. He knew the right buttons to push. He knew the right things to say to me. He said some beautifully romantic things that I haven't heard in many, many years.
So we heard that reaction. I mean, this is a person who was convinced to give up her life insurance and pension benefits and has now become a victim's advocate. I want you to sort of walk us through who is the type of person that a scammer would target.
Right. And I want to sort of set the stage a little bit, right? Everybody is susceptible to this, right? There's no one type of victim. You've had people who are cybersecurity professionals who have fallen for this. Mm. You've had well-educated people who have fallen for this. One of the first things that, unfortunately, society views, right, the victim is, how could you have fallen for something like that? How could you be so stupid?
Yeah.
That is the worst thing you can do, because what you're doing is you're re-victimizing the person, essentially, and shutting that person down, right? So who can fall for this? Having said that, you know, there are, going back to what Avi said here earlier, we were all experiencing isolation, loneliness. You can't go to a physical space and meet somebody. A lot of people lost their spouses during the pandemic.
Yeah.
So, you know, people that you've spent 40, 50 years, you know, together with, right? And it's a very scary time to, you know, be alone. Your children may have moved out, you're empty nesters. This is exactly what scammers are going to prey on. So they're going to look at, you know, things like, are you lonely? You know, maybe based on your profile, try to figure out, is this a good person to target because they might have some funds saved, right? So again, how much of you are you putting out there that is going to make people target you more often? So it could be an assortment of things that they're looking at.
Let me reintroduce you. We are talking about romance scams, which are on the rise, with Anshul Rege, a professor at Temple University who studies romance scams and is also an expert in criminology and cybersecurity. If you want to join the conversation, perhaps you have a question on this topic, you can call us at 888-477-9499, or you can email us at studio2@whyy.org. One thing I've always wondered is how this investment of time is really worth it for the scammers, because as you mentioned, this is months of priming and establishing trust and a relationship, and that's a lot of focused effort that might not result in anything when you start to ask for that money. How is this good business for the scammers themselves?
Right, that's a great question. So scammers come in all, you know, shapes and forms, right? You could have an individual person targeting a couple of people, or you could have a very sophisticated network, right? And if you're looking at those types, the larger networks, which are located all over the world, you have dedicated sort of sub-nodes, if you will, in this network that are going to be focused on specific parts of it. So the first one node might be dedicated to just reaching out to people.
Mm.
Another node might then be like, okay, you know, we've got these people hooked. Here's the next team to work on, you know, grooming them. And in rotation, it's
that
not
is
one
so sophisticated.
It is, right? And they have playbooks for this. So there's actually scammer playbooks that were leaked online. And you can see that these are 30, 40, 50 page playbooks that say, hey, you want to initiate contact? Use these taglines. If you want to, you know, groom them, here's some paragraphs or essays that you can use to send. And it's literally copy and paste with a slight adjustment, right? These are the different personas that you could take on. These are the different tragic set of circumstances that you're going to lay on. Don't be too greedy. Mm-hmm. Don't ask for it, right? So it's all of these things. And so it's a very well-oiled machine that is very much in tune to divvying up the tasks and doing it. In terms of return on investment, they actually have it down to a science, right? So I remember many years ago, I had read actually an article where scammers had said, well, you know, we just blast connections out. Even if we get 7% response, it is 75% likely that we're going to get their funds. So they figured out the math.
Wow.
And that was a couple of years ago, right? Sort of, that's still, you know, human labor that's involved in this. You mentioned earlier, Avi, that there's also automation that's going to be happening with AI. Mm. That is just going to change the playing field completely because it takes away the burden on the scammer to sit there and invest actually engage it, right? How can you
could have multiple scams going at once. Wow. One person could be controlling all of
them.
Interesting.
So I'm like the talking about the victims here. It's like I'm like sitting here because I've done online dating and I know a lot of people who do. They found their person online, and there's a lot of I'm a very skeptical person, and I think about, what should you be paying attention to? Because I see some of these scams, people have gone a year, 2 years, never seen this person, never met this person. Can you walk us through like some of the thought processes from the victim side as to justification for not actually having that human connection? Or does it happen and, you know, and you still end up scammed?
Right. And, you know, there have been victims that have said, I knew something was off.
Yeah.
Right? Like, why can't we do a video call? Why is he not available to meet me in person? Why is he always off at these conferences or whatever it may be? But you're still hopeful, right? That's at the core of your human emotion, is that need and longing, right, to be loved and to have that special someone in your life. And so, you know, you're hearing things that you want to hear. It's almost like a psychological biochemical reaction, right, that's going on in your brain. You've got that good feelings. Yeah. And once you have that, you don't want to let go. So it's those types of emotions that, again, you know, people are like, you know, I should have known, or, oh, looking back, these types of telltale signs. But when you're in the heat of it, right, in the thick of it, you don't want to believe it.
And a quick follow up to that. I mean, are there red flags, though? I mean, because is that a red flag that you haven't seen this person and y'all haven't linked up for dinner or something?
Yeah, absolutely, right? Not meeting is one. Okay, you can't meet. How about doing a face call, right? FaceTime, video, whatever it is. Can't do that, right? Something's off in terms of the story. A lot of times you don't look for contradictions in the narratives. So they might say something today and fast forward like a couple of weeks, they might have contradicted that earlier. Something doesn't add up, or, you know, hey, I did give you money. Why do you still need it for that reason? Right. So there's lots of times and you've got to put your, you know, sort of foot on the brakes and be like, really? And there are those types of red flags.
Something you said earlier really stuck out to me, this idea that once you start getting these positive emotions, that flood of good feeling comes in, you're going to try to want to justify it to yourself. You're going to want to make it real to yourself, and that doubt is going to get pushed further and further into the back of your mind. Is there a way to counteract that? Because we're talking about human biology here. I mean, this is like core stuff.
Yeah. If only it were that easy, right?
I mean,
there are times when friends and family have intervened, and this has caused a lot of tension between families, between loved ones, right? And it's hard. It's hard to get out of it. But some folks, and this, I think, you know, this is sort of outside of my wheelhouse, the biology of it, the physiology of things and things like that. there have been some individuals that have had that aha moment, right? Mm-hmm. Like the bulb goes off and they're like, no, you know, I'm not going to do it. Or when they finally do open up to friends, like, oh, I have this special someone, and they ask them certain types of questions and they cannot answer or they cannot defend to this other person, then it dawns on them, right? But a lot of times what scammers will do is they'll try to isolate the victim too, to prevent them from revealing.
From the interferers.
Yeah, exactly, right? So it's all down. They have it all figured out, is how do I keep this person isolated? How do I keep brainwashing them using love bombing? And then just weave the story endlessly and keep them hooked in it.
Yeah, and I want to bring in this comment from Abby. She's in her 60s. She's single. She's looking for a man. She says, I'm not able to find someone in local bars, but I also hesitate to sign up for an online dating profile. How likely is it to get scammed? And we were talking about red flags, and she also asked about that. So how likely is it?
I don't think we've got, you know, complete numbers or things like that down. It is, obviously, you refer to the FTC report that came out. Mm-hmm. $1.3 billion, right, dollars in losses. So having said that, and that's probably not even the complete amount, right? Because a lot of people are so embarrassed that they're not even going to report it. So what the numbers that you saw, right, are not even the true numbers. So having said that, you know, they're out there, you know, they're just waiting, and there's an endless sea of victims that they can, you know, sort of fish, right, and target. So it is likely. And so those red flags are particular. And if you're thinking about it, Abby, right, it was, yes. You know, look for, you know, the age old sort of phrase, right? If it's too good to be true, it probably is. Yeah. If someone's like too perfect, right, that might be something to look for. If you create an account and all of a sudden you're bombarded with messages, that's a little odd. And frequently, you know, the obvious ones that we've all, you know, familiarized ourselves with, look for the language, look for, you know, those types of, you know, what are they talking about, right? Try to find issues. Are they overly lovey-dovey the moment you've connected?
Interesting.
Those types of things, you're like,
because zero to 60 might be
zero to 60, exactly, right? No, that's not normal. That's not real. That's not what I think, right?
But it's not how most romances
exactly
happen,
right? And so there's nothing wrong with online dating, but there's certain things that you have to just be a little bit more particular about, right? In terms of protecting yourself. And talk. And that's the other thing I would tell Abby is, if you're creating this profile, let people around you that you love, right, know from the get-go. It's like, hey, I'm going to see what comes up. Let them know who you're talking to. And look these people up online.
Yeah.
Right? This is like the easiest thing to do. Does this person exist? And, you know, in some cases, it's, you know, it's real, which is good. Yeah. In others, you've probably got, you know, some poor soul somewhere who doesn't even know that, you know.
Exactly. Google is your friend, basically.
Google is your friend. Yeah. Reverse image search it. So.
So just to reintroduce you, we're talking with Anshul Rege, who is a Temple University professor who studies romance scams, and that's what we're talking about this hour, romance scams. If you want to contribute to the conversation, you can call us 888-477-9499, or you can email us studio2@whyy.org. Email from Jenny. This is more of a comment than a question, who says that a lot of the hallmarks, the red flags you're talking about, are really indicators of an abusive relationship, not just online scamming. So that Jenny is seeing some reflection there between what scammers do and what people who might be in an abusive relationship would do.
Yeah. And you know, and that's a great point too, is you see that a lot of times people who are in abusive relationships don't leave them either because of that cyclical sort of, you know, nature. It's like, oh, you experienced something bad, but that's going to be followed up by something that's very positive, right? So you're like, oh,
similar,
I'll give
psychology.
This. So I'll give you that second chance. It's okay. We've already invested so much time in this. It's got to work out, right? So that kind of mindset.
Interesting.
I want to talk about the different reasons people give to get money from you. Like, first of all, that would be a red flag to me when you start asking for money and I've never met you in person. Just sort of like, what are some of the reasons? Because there's like people, investment scams. There's so many different types of money asks. Can you go over a few of the more popular ones?
Sure. So the traditional ones, right, where like medical emergencies, needing funds to secure travel documents to come see you. Again, depending on the pretext or the narrative that you've set up, right, depending on if you are a construction worker in a foreign, you know, so, oil rig or whatever it may be, right, your ask would be catered to that. So I need equipment. I need supplies. If you have children, you know, tuition, toys, whatever it may be, medical emergencies, legal problems, right? So these are the typical ones that we've seen. A more recent sort of trend is something known as the pig butchering scams. Mm. And what happens is you start out with a romantic sort of interest. And during the love bombing stage, right, you're going to start saying things like, oh, you know what I would love for us to do is not have to work every single day, mm-hmm. you know, that we could just invest and then we could live off of the interest and you and I could go travel the world and we could spread our love everywhere, right? Like those, and these things are said. So what do scammers do? And this is where you have the intersection of romance scams and cryptocurrency, right? So you're going to tell your potential victim, hey, I have invested in this cryptocurrency scheme, which is doing really great. Look at my returns. And you'll send a screenshot, which is not real, that you're making millions and millions of dollars. And I want you to experience this success, too, because that's how much I love you.
Yeah.
I want you to succeed, too. Right. And so people will start small amounts. Try 1,000. And this actually happened to a lady here in the, you know, PA suburbs, right? So she, you know, so you put in maybe 1,000, you start seeing 1,250 that you can withdraw. Okay. And so once you sort of feel that comfortable, oh, okay, my money's not in some scam scheme, right? Like I can get it back. Then you up it to 6,000, right? And then you get
more and more.
And then you get 9,000. To the point where some souls have liquidated their 401ks
in these pig butchering scams.
Wow. And so that's what pig butchering is, right?
We don't have a ton of time left. Yeah. We do want to bring in a caller. This is Christine, who's using an alias, by the way. This is not Christine's real name. Christine is on the phone and wants to talk about the responsibility online sites should take. Christine, what's your comment or question? You're on Studio 2.
Hi, yes. I would just love a discussion to occur around the responsibility and culpability of these sites themselves. Quickly, a few years ago, I went on a site for the more mature single adult, and I came across profile after profile. Mm. Same picture, different profile. Same profile, different photo. Again and again and again. It was so maddening. Yeah. I would just like that to be addressed.
All right, so we only have a couple minutes left, but, I mean, are these sites doing any policing, or is it just a free-for-all out there?
They are, but it's also very hard to keep up, right? And I'm not saying that that's an excuse, obviously, but, you know, there are bot detection programs that they have. They have sort of looking for grammar, looking at IP addresses, right? Looking at those types of things have been around, using actually artificial intelligence to combat that, like in terms of detection, right? The problem becomes is when you shut certain accounts down, they're just going to resurface.
Yeah, they just regenerate.
And that is the beauty of what is the internet.
Yep. Yeah. That's interesting to me, too, is like it seems like AI could make this worse, but it's also part of the solution. Where does AI fit into the future of online romance scams? I know we only have about a minute. That's making it tough on you, but if you could just get into that a little.
Yeah. ChatGPT, that's one where scammers have already started to use that in terms of having conversations that feel natural and authentic, right? So this is already happening. Deepfakes are being used. So initially when you said you couldn't FaceTime someone and that was a red flag because they're not coming on, you now have deepfakes that can do the talking for you and you feel like you're talking to a real person. You can have voice simulators that can make you take on any sound. So there's, you know.
There's a lot.
There's a lot. Yeah, absolutely. It's only going to get trickier and more interesting.
But I hope, Ancho, that people do not give up on love, though.
No, of course not. And they should not. They should not, yeah. Right? Yeah.
And now they're armed with some tools, hopefully, to help them navigate this world a little better. Thank you so much. That's Anshul Rege, professor at Temple University in criminology and cybersecurity. Thanks for joining us on Studio 2. Fascinating stuff.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes. And coming up, peanut allergy and a new possible treatment. Stick with us. Lots to come.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt here with Cherry Gregg. If you are a parent of a child with severe food allergies, you know that thought. It's an unsettling thought of a peanut or any type of food, a small bit of exposure leading to a trip to the ER.
Yeah, Avi, and it seems like it's becoming even more pressing these days given the increase in child peanut allergies. A recent study out of Mount Sinai found that peanut allergies in kids nearly tripled from 1997 to 2008. A lot of elementary schools are now nut-free. They've ditched the old school PB&J at lunch and they've banned peanuts at snack time. And I know a lot of planes you get on, they tell you, please don't eat the peanuts.
No peanuts, small pretzels now. Thankfully, researchers have dedicated a lot of time to this area, and the latest approach is showing promise. It's called a peanut patch, and it is just what it sounds like. It's an adhesive patch that contains a small amount of peanut. And here to tell us about it is Dr. Terry Brown Whitehorn from the Division of Allergy and Immunology at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Dr. Terry Brown Whitehorn, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I want to start with the peanut patch. Like, what is it and what does it do that's making folks so excited?
So it's a patch that has 1/1000th of a peanut, and the families apply it to the child's back. And on our back, there's some immune cells. And that the hope is that it can change the child's immune system so that instead of having a severe reaction to a really small amount, they may tolerate more.
I feel like embedded in the theory of this patch is kind of the underlying problem. So I wanted to ask about that. Why have we seen an increase in children who are severely allergic to peanuts?
So we've seen an increase in peanut allergy, but we've seen an increase in all food allergies, actually. And some of that has to do with how and when, actually, the actual food is introduced. Years ago, we used to tell people don't introduce milk, egg, peanut until kids were older. Certainly with peanut, you don't want to have a choking hazard. But in the U.S., where that was done, there was a significant increase in peanut allergy. We looked at what was happening in Israel in a study where they actually give babies peanut early and they don't have as much peanut allergy. And so that has been flipped. So now we recommend early introduction of some of the higher allergens.
So lack of exposure was leading to allergy development, it seems like.
Seems like it. I think it's way more complicated than that. But yes, I do think that delay in introduction and having our immune systems see these foods certainly led to an increase.
Yeah, and you helped lead a study at CHOP that looked at this exposure of small amounts. Talk about the study and what did you all find?
Sure. We were one of the many sites that was involved in a study looking at children between 1 and 3, actually, with peanut allergy. And they had to wear a patch 24 hours a day. Every day they changed the patch. And the question was, did wearing a patch change the amount of peanut that a child may tolerate? So one peanut has 250 milligrams of peanut protein. And the children we'd had to know that they were allergic to peanut. They'd have to have a food challenge, and the families had to consent to this. So you kind of knew where they started, how many milligrams of peanut caused a problem. And then these courageous families had their children wore these patches. Two-thirds of the kids got a peanut patch, and one-third had placebo without peanut. And then they had a food challenge at the end of 12 months. And what we found is that the children who were very, very sensitive to peanut, one-tenth of a peanut or even less, that if they got to the ability to eat a single peanut and didn't have a reaction, that was one cohort of patients. The other group were kids who still had a reaction. It could be bad at the beginning, but they tolerated a little bit more. How many were able to eat three peanuts? And what we found is that the kids who had the peanut patch did significantly better than those who did not. So it was kind of exciting to be a part of it and to be part of these families' lives.
How did those results compare to other therapies? Because I understand that there are other treatments to try to at least ameliorate the effects of these allergies for children who are severely allergic. So is this patch better performing than those other therapies? Does it perform about as well from what we can tell in this one study?
Sure. I mean, we recommend that all children who have these food allergies that while they're in these studies, they're supposed to avoid the food. And so strict avoidance is still what is recommended. There's no FDA-approved therapy for peanut allergy in the toddler age group. In kids 4 and older, there's something called oral immunotherapy where that kids actually eat the amount of peanut slowly and gradually increase the amount. And I'd just like to tell everyone that you shouldn't do this at home. We've had kids have allergic reactions, so it needs to be done in a center where families are well informed. So when you do oral immunotherapy, the kids need to be restricted in terms of the activities after they take doses. They can't run, play, jump as much for a couple hours after. With the peanut patch, we haven't seen that to be a problem. For all of these studies, especially for peanut in particular, we want to make sure, or our goal, you know, of course our goal is to cure food allergy and so no one would have it, but at the very least, we want to increase the amount of the food that's needed to perhaps cause a reaction so that if they take a bite of a baked good, they won't have a severe reaction. They may notice that there's peanut in it, you know, swallow it or spit it out, but they won't end up in our emergency rooms.
One small mistake won't lead to a tragedy.
Correct.
And I want to talk about the families. You mentioned the families involved. I mean, these are 1 to 3-year-olds. You know, I can imagine it's pretty scary putting your kids in harm's way. Like, sort of what were the ranges of reaction and how courageous do you think these families were putting their kids in it in the study?
So these children had to be known to be allergic. They had to meet certain blood tests, skin tests, all of these things. And then the families have to realize that they're going to have a food challenge. And if they don't tolerate the food, they know, you know, they've seen their child have an allergic reaction. But the drive is to keep their children safe. So they've seen a bad reaction, and then they want to prevent it. And at this point, you know, research is what is available to them. So,
What do you want to learn next about the peanut patch? What, in terms of its efficacy, maybe its side effects, its scalability, like what is the next frontier of this research?
Well, I'm glad you asked. I mean, I think we know that it doesn't work in everyone. The FDA the FDA didn't approve it initially because the adhesive on the patch they didn't find as successful as they wanted, and so there'll be more studies or an additional study that's coming out, and so we want to be able to give it, you know, apply it to other children and see if it works, see if it works in different age groups. We think that the younger the child is, the more likely it will work, but it doesn't mean that it won't work in someone else. And for children who have very, very severe peanut allergy where they end up in our intensive care unit, you know, you really want to provide some sort of safety. And this may be for those kids very helpful as well.
Do we have a time horizon here about when we might see this on market, or is it too early to say?
I think right now it's too early to say, but
well,
yes.
Then maybe a conversation for another time. Thanks so much for joining us here on Studio 2, Terry.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That is Dr. Terry Brown Whitehorn. She is the attending physician at the Division of Allergy and Immunology at CHOP and a professor of clinical pediatrics at Perelman School of Medicine at Penn. And that, my friends, is it for us today. You can head to whyy.org/studio2 for more and find us wherever you get your podcasts.
And you can rate and review on podcast page. It helps us a lot. Our producers are Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Our engineer is Al Banks from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. My name is Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Enjoy your afternoon.